So yeah, the title of my talk is spin orbit coupling effects in solid state and cold atomic systems, and I'll be talking about a few works which have been done in collaboration with Anton Burkov, who is now a postdoc at Harvard, moving to Waterloo for a more permanent position, Shankar Desarmuri, University of Maryland, and Tudor Stanescu and Chunwei Zhang for a postdoc at the University of Maryland. And I should mention the fact that Tudor Stanescu was the one who's been doing all the work, so mostly.
Is he a student?
No, he's a postdoc. He's a postdoc. So this is the outline. Okay, may I turn on this thing? This is the outline of my talk, and roughly my talk will consist of two parts. So the first will be a condensed matter part, and the second one will be cold atom part. And the condensed matter part is expected to take about 75% of my time, and this will be 25%. So I thought that I perhaps should apologize for not having enough AMO physics in my talk, but having been here for 2 weeks, I haven't heard a single AMO talk so far, so maybe 25% is good enough. So anyway, so this is the plan, and first I will give a kind of historical introduction into the subject of spin transport, and this will involve a theory developed by Haldane, Shuxin Zhang, and many others, which involve the notion of Fermi's surface baryspace, and this is quite elegant mathematical structure, and it gives some kind of intuitive understanding of what might be going on in real systems in terms of spin transfer in response to, say, linear, in response to electric field. But it also, this theory, as I will show you, has some problems, namely, it is difficult to describe observable effects like spin densities and such. And so this was the motivation for us to basically develop a different theory in some sense. And this is what I will explain in the main part of my talk. So here I will talk about spin transfer in clean condensed matter systems. And I will show that there are some very interesting localized edge states which carry spin, and they play an important role in spin transfer. Then I will talk about disordered spin orbit coupled systems and derive kind of in hydrodynamic approximation derive spin diffusion equation, which will have some unusual form, and I will show how to solve this unusual diffusion equation and formulate the appropriate boundary conditions. So as I mentioned in the last part of my talk, I will describe how to create basically a spin orbit coupling Hamiltonian in a cold atomic system, and discuss what kind of effects we can study there, and this will be strongly non-equilibrium spin dynamics. Okay, so this is the plan. Let me start with reminding some very basic thing about baryspace. So suppose we have a Hamiltonian H, which depends on a parameter lambda. So and this parameter lives in a certain parameter space. It can be a three-dimensional space, but it doesn't have to be three-dimensional. So suppose we change this parameter adiabatically, so the parameter forms a loop in this parameter space. So we all know that the wave function acquires a phase, which is the baryspace. And what is important in this context is that this baryspace can be thought of as a flux of an artificial magnetic field which lives in this parameter space, or a circulation of the corresponding vector potential. So a flux through this surface which is enclosed by this loop. So, and what is important also, and this has been realized by Michael Garian, actually appears in his original paper, is that degeneracies in the spectrum are sources of this kind of artificial magnetic field. So that is, we have a Hamiltonian which depends on a parameter lambda, so we have a spectrum which also depends on the same parameter. And there might be some values of the parameter for which the spectrum is degenerate. So a trivial example is spin in a magnetic field, so if magnetic field is zero, obviously you have something wrong. So in these points in the parameter space are like sources, or if you want a fancy name, monopoles of this artificial magnetic field. So and this observation has important consequences in many systems, and in particular, a system as mundane as basically electron block state in a crystal in a periodic potential already shows some effects which are associated with this baryspace. So suppose we have an electron in a crystal, so periodic potential creates bands, and so these bands may cross. So these crossing points in momentum space are just like these band degeneracies, so degeneracies in the spectrum, and they lead to a non-trivial basically topological structure with the corresponding Fermi surface. So and to calculate the corresponding vector potential, so to speak, all we have to do is basically to calculate this product of the periodic part of the block wave function and the derivative of the periodic part of the block wave function with respect to momentum. So, and this thing is not just merely a mathematical abstraction, it actually leads to some observable effects. So, and it was understood back in the 50s by Karplus and Lattinger. They, of course, didn't call it gauge field, or definitely didn't call it perispace, but they had all equations right, and so the equations are basically the following. So these are just quasi-classical equations of motion for an electron in a band. So basically, you create a wave packet in a certain band, which is labeled by this index n, and you look at the quasi-classical dynamics. And what you find is that, well, of course, you have just the trivial, you know, the usual Newton equation, but also you have an equation for the derivative of the position of this wave packet, and this equation has an anomalous term. So, and this anomalous term, which is called now anomalous velocity, just looks just like Lorentz force, but in momentum space. So it's kind of dual magnetic field. And by the way, this magnetic field is just the curl of this vector potential that I just described in the previous transparency. So I should mention that, in fact, these quasi-classical equations of motion were recently re-derived and emphasized in a very elegant way by Sundram and New. So New actually gave a talk on this, so I'm kind of repeating what he said. So it's really elegant construction. Also, Haldane wrote a paper about that, so it's very interesting. But again, so in principle, these equations in the context of just electrons in a crystal, so it was understood by Lattinger back in the 50s. And there were also some interesting generalizations, which I'm not going to discuss in any great detail, but I would like to mention them. So in principle, one may have a more complicated structure of these quasi-classical equations of motion if you have degenerate bands which cross. So for instance, if you have a Lattinger model, you have heavy poles and light poles, and these are double degenerate bands, so they may cross, and the result of this would be a magnetic field, basically, which is a matrix, so it's non-abelian. It's non-abelian means it's a matrix. So, and there will be some spinor index within the band. Also, Shindo and Balenz here in Santa Barbara generalized this construction to a situation when you have basically interacting particles, in which case you have basically some dynamics of the band. So there is a frequency which appears in various expressions. And what you can have here is another term which looks like a dual electric field, so which is also quite interesting.
The first term sort of already looks like an electric field. Right?
Hmm?
The first term already looks like an electric field.
Well, it's just the derivative of the spectrum.
Right, so I'm saying it looks like an electric field.
Yeah, but what they did was basically different. So they, I mentioned that you can calculate this vector potential just by, you know, by calculating this type of derivative. So, but okay, what you want is to create an electric field. You want a derivative with respect to frequency. So if there is no frequency anywhere in this kind of band structure. But if you include interactions, at least that's my understanding, if you include interactions, so basically you can write a Green's function. And there will be some self-energy. Mm-hmm. So, and self-energy depends on frequency and momentum. And so you can diagonalize, you know, you can say that this is basically your Hamiltonian. This is one of your Hamiltonians. So you diagonalize this matrix, and you have a certain
frequency dependent,
you know, unitary matrix which diagonalizes it, and so then it basically this U is so this okay the components of this matrix are these bands essentially. So and so it acquires frequency dependence, and you can get something out of it. So well, but again, so this is not the subject of my talk by any means. I just wanted to mention.
Right. So no, I guess the first term is like a gradient of scalar potential in momentum space, and this is like a dadt term.
Right. Yes. Absolutely.
So it's equals minus graphi minus dadt.
Yeah. So okay. So I will also mention that in principle we're now working on a project in which one can actually get kind of dynamic gauge field. So if you consider a situation near phase transition, so you may actually have some non-trivial dynamics of this dual potential. But these are just some remarks, though, that this is not the most general structure of this anomalous velocity. Anyway, so what I want to say here is that the important observation is that to have this kind of anomalous velocity, all you need is just a degenerate of the band structure. So you don't really need a crystal potential for that. So whenever you have a band structure which involves a degeneracy, so you will get it. And
may I ask you,
sure.
In, in standard solid state physics, people write this equation without a normal velocity.
No, actually, it depends on what you call standard.
Okay, so if you take, for example, Kittel book or
well, okay, so well, that's basically that's bad because it is there. So if you actually take the papers of Leitinger, so they include this thing. So yeah. In most cases, you don't have to worry about this. So it's not often you have to worry about this thing. So actually, you have to look for effects which are associated with this, for observable effects. But this term definitely exists.
For example, theory of electromagnetic phenomena in solids like oscillations.
Well, it's not completely true. So it's necessary whenever you have to have these band crossings, which involve the band which conducts basically. So in fact, in Shubnikov-Degas, I'm not an expert on this, but there have been some papers which basically so there is a parameter gamma in the Shubnikov-Degas oscillations. Mm-hmm. So and it may have different values depending whether or not you have these types of things. So it's not that it's some crazy physics. Actually, it does appear in the papers of Leitinger. They just didn't call it anomalous velocity or anything. So they had all the equations which involve these derivatives and such. So and that was
In Langer, maybe without the benefit of Barry's phase, Barry's insight, how does this term come about?
Well, they just straightforwardly considered this block periodic parts of the block wave functions and
the fact that it depends
derived, on the derived the equations of motions and in a magnetic field and without magnetic field. Mm-hmm. And so these terms just naturally come in. So and again, so there is nothing.
I think I'll just repeat the question. So if you start with string equation in periodic potential, although it's not necessary for you, but still, and then derive some classical equations for dynamics of electron, as it done indeed in the text, right?
So what you want here is a semi-classical dynamics of a wave packet in a band. So basically you create, it's not necessarily, first of all, I should mention that it's not exactly what I'm going to be talking about. This was supposed to be motivation for me and to explain the motivation. It's not my work, there is no my name here. So although, but this exists, this is not some, crazy thing. So if you, what you really want to do, you want to say that, so you have these bands, and what I want to study an adiabatic motion of a wave packet in the band. So if it is in a band, it stays in this band forever. So there is no interband transitions, anything like that. So and if you derive, you can derive Lagrangian for this motion. It has been done in this paper by Sindrum and Yu, and it will involve these terms. So let me just show you. I was not supposed to talk about the periodic potential actually. So the point was that you have this term in the semi-classical equations of motion whenever you have a band crossing.
Can you just give an idea of whether this term enters with some small parameter?
No. Okay, so the small parameter. This p dot can be zero. Okay. So if you don't apply,
very nice picture. Suppose my band crossing is some ultraviolet property. Actually, I have some parabolic dispersion relation. My energy is very very low. So I'm in the just in the bottom of some parabolic. And this band crossing is somewhere some huge momentum. And naively, I would say that probably this term will contain some small parameter.
Actually, the answer is no, at least within this approach. So again, and the approach is that you create a wave packet in a band. So if you allow interband transitions, so this picture will be completely smeared out. So, for instance, if you include disorder in the system and such, and I will talk about this in some detail. But if you just consider, adiabatic motion of a particle in certain bands, so it will always.
My idea is very simple. The second band corresponds to some huge energy, so that the degeneracy you are talking about happens at huge energy, which probably I can never feel. If I'm at the bottom of my band, so naively.
Well, it's like the other way around. We'll see. So, this is a picture which you perhaps are talking about. And let me. So it's the other way around. So in principle, you have high Fermi energy, and you have very far below. You have you have a degeneracy. And it doesn't matter how you know, what is the boundary. So it doesn't matter how far is it from the Fermi energy, you will always feel it in your equations of motion. So that's a state that, well.
And so this picture, epsilon n is equal to 1 and 2 for the two bands, where you have n equals just 1 and then some Fourier parameterized.
No, 1 and 2. So you have for both bands, you basically you have this term, and well, it usually has opposite signs for.
Can I put it differently? So in this Barry's picture, so we can be pretty far away from the degeneracy point, but in this case, the area, the solid angle, should be large enough. Otherwise, the Barry's phase will be small and probably will not.
Well, that's maybe for correct intuition.
So but basically, then in this case, I need the density of the solid angle of my path, of my adiabatic path, to be large enough. Otherwise, I will not feel this case.
So maybe you're right, but bottom line is that if you derive this equation, there will be no small parameter. It doesn't matter how far it is from the. Okay, so let me continue. Okay, so
wait. I have one more question about this anomalous velocity. So there is this effective magnetic field, and the question is, does it contain H bar? It's in a classical description. I wanted to know if it survives when H bar.
No.
It's
always the Barry space doesn't contain H. That is classical effect.
So these two equations for R dot and P dot are just classical equations. Mm-hmm. H bar is already taken.
Yeah, it's still like Coriolis force, something like that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so anyway, so the purpose of this discussion was basically to come to spin orbit couple systems. So if you, whenever you have a spin orbit coupling, it doesn't really matter what the coupling is. So you add a spin orbit, spin dependent term to the Hamiltonian, you have splitting of the bands, and you necessarily will have this degeneracy point. So here I just list the most popular spin orbit coupling Hamiltonians. So the first one is the Luttinger Hamiltonian, which describes, three-dimensional full-loop semiconductor, and G here is a 4x4 matrix, spin 3/2 matrix. So in gamma usually is a parameter which is not by any means small, so it's an important effect. So in two-dimensional systems, usually people study this type of spin orbit coupling, and it has the form of a kind of Zeeman term with a momentum-dependent magnetic field. And so this momentum dependence can have different forms, and for some reason that I'm unable to explain, so this Rajb interaction is the most popular form of the of this interaction. So it's just P cross Z term. So, but also,
what is J?
J is okay. This is 3D whole lobe semiconductor. So the effective spin is 3/2 actually. It's basically matrix 4x4 matrix. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering, by the way, after your talk, whether you can have anything like that in this model. Well, you were talking about spin 3/2.
The interaction implement is fine, but the problem here is the kinetic energy. P dots,
right.
So there's no, only as you close.
Yeah, but anyway, so this is the Rajb term, and also people consider a linear and cubic Dresser-Kauss terms, which have this form. And so if you look at just the band structure, so it has this form of two intersecting cones, and well, you do have this kind of degeneracy point here, and according to what I told you, so this degeneracy should lead to non-trivial, basically, Barry space for the bands. So I note in passing, by the way, so usually in systems that, we consider, so the Fermi energy is very, very high up, compared to this degeneracy point. But in principle, it's completely reasonable to consider a situation in which, the chemical potential will be tuned to this point. And if you do, well, there is actually an interesting topological phase transition. So in fact, the spectrum here is linear, which is kind of the R spectrum.
So which this spectrum is for which for this?
Well, I think it's for rational. Okay. Yes. So, but you will have similar things for any model. Well, and so in the observation is that you have this anomalous velocity and you have bands and they are related to spin. So maybe you have some interesting spin effects associated with this. And this was realized by many people, in particular by Murakami et al. And some others. For instance, Murakami et al., they consider a spin orbit coupled system, namely in their case it was Luttinger model, an external electric field. And so they concentrated on this, again, on this kind of anomalous velocity, this dual magnetic field structure. Mm-hmm. And so if you do a calculation, and the calculation being the following, so basically you take a matrix U which diagonalizes the Hamiltonian. So U is the matrix which diagonalizes the Hamiltonian. So you then calculate basically the diagonal parts corresponding to the band indices of this derivative, you know, u dagger dpu. And this will give you this vector potential, which will also have a label corresponding to the band indices. Then you calculate, well, it's a little more complicated in the Lattice model, but just to simplify things, you calculate this to the curl of this vector potential in momentum space, and this will give you this, you know, magnetic field.
But wait, so the many, the several magnetic fields, one for each?
Yeah, for each band you have different value of the magnetic.
Okay.
So there is a band index lambda, which in this case is nothing but just the index which labels the heavy light holes. Well, and so it turns out that the expression for this dual magnetic field momentum space proportional to P, you know, vector P over P cubed, which is actually like a monopole, so it's kind of neat. So, and there is electric field to which this P dot is proportional.
Is that generic, this P over P
cubed? No.
No.
That happens. So, again, I'm spending too much time on what I didn't want to talk about. But so this was what they did. And so you have this anomalous velocity, and then you can basically define something that you can want to call spin current. In this case, it's going to be basically, it should have been J. But spin matrix.
And this is the definition?
Well, so I will discuss it. Actually, I don't, so this is the main problem with this approach. So you can define any Hermitian operator you like, and you can call it whatever you want. What usually is done in this, within this theory is that people define something that they want to call spin current and calculate this. And you can definitely do linear response with it within this definition. So in this particular case, you just plug in the expression for the anomalous velocity and sum over different bands and calculate over momentum. Well, I should put the distribution function here, and you will get a non-zero spin current. Okay.
How does it relate to some measurable?
Well, that's exactly the subject of my talk. So, the result is that there is a spin current flowing perpendicular to the electric field. And the conjecture was that, intuition kind of, that this spin current leads to spin accumulation at the edges. So this was conjecture. And the conjecture, in fact, is reasonable. So it kind of qualitatively describes the, what's going on. So let me just show you the experiment, which actually was done here in Santa Barbara again. So, and it is an experiment on gallium arsenide or indium gallium arsenide films in which, it's an Echelon's group, I guess. So you apply electric field parallel to, you know, to the edges, and what you observe, you know, this blue region and red region are excess spin densities, so you have non-zero spin accumulation near the edges. So it's still being debated whether this is an intrinsic effect, that is, whether it relates to this anomalous velocity or its extrinsic effect, but there is no question that the effect exists. So, this is an experiment.
What is measured here?
So what is measured, in fact, I don't know great details about the experimental measure, but my understanding is that they did a care rotation measurement near the edges. So
care rotation.
Yes.
Okay.
So.
So is it possible having your spin current calculate what is the intensity of?
Well, in fact, the general answer is no.
No.
Well, so you have to do something else. So, but the kind of the effect itself is consistent with what you would expect in this picture. So the sign of the effect.
So it's qualitative.
So and this is exactly what I wanted to say. So this was kind of a conventional picture, which many people, and it's a very elegant picture. I actually like it very much. So, but the problem with this picture is that there is a large gap between the experiment, which is just what you said, which measures spin density, and the Paris phase approach, which calculates some spin currents. And an important question, which you actually just asked, what is the connection between them, if any? Mm-hmm. So, and I'm not sure of the answer. So there is a connection, definitely. But there are also problems. And so the main problem is the following. So if you have, your spin orbit coupled Hamiltonian, and you calculate the commutator of the spin with this Hamiltonian, it's not going to be zero. So the spin is not conserved. And there is no continuity equation for any current, basically. So that's, there is no obvious relation. There's no obvious relation between, you know, the spin current, the whole current, and observables. And another problem which I will address also is that the concept of this Fermi surface Paris phase, which again, I mean, I find very interesting and elegant, well, it cannot be generalized to these sort of systems, which are, again, I guess, experimentally studied systems in condensed matrix physics. So, and this was basically motivation for us to look directly at the observables and see what happens with the density instead of currents. But I should mention that, you know, this is kind of useful tool to develop some intuition about what's going on. But I'm not sure about the And so this is, again, mostly has been done by Peter Stanescu. And what I'm going to be talking about in the next maybe 5 minutes or so is physics of spin accumulation in a clean spin orbit coupled system. And we considered Luttinger model, but it was just an example. So it doesn't have to be Luttinger. And so the main idea can be understood very easily. In fact, you don't need any many-body physics to do that. So, well, you have your Hamiltonian. And suppose we have, okay, this is Luttinger Hamiltonian derivative, some parameter. So this J is a matrix, you know, spin matrix. In this case, a spin 3/2 doesn't have to be. So, and this is, okay, I want to consider it as a single particle Hamiltonian. And so this Hamiltonian has two bands, okay, heavy holes and light holes. Now, and I want to consider this Hamiltonian in the presence of a boundary. So for simplicity, let me consider it to be a hard hole.
So I didn't understand the comment about heavy and light. So the psi is a two-component object?
Four-component, but okay, for simplicity, let's think about this two-component. So you can diagonalize this Hamiltonian. You can just replace, you know, gradients with p. Okay.
And then now you have a matrix for that.
You have a matrix. You can find the eigenvalues of this matrix. And it will involve, you know, heavy holes, light holes, rather standard picture.
Okay.
So whenever you have kind of spin orbit coupling, you always will get this. So these are basically the bands which I'm talking about.
If it was 2 by 2, so but 3 by 3 corresponds to.
No, three.
I mean 4 by 4 corresponds to what?
So 4 by 4 corresponds to the following. So again, so in real, you know, in semiconductors, right. So the effective spin is 3/2. So it's kind of
for a hole, yeah.
Yeah, for a hole.
Okay.
So, and the, well, spin 3/2 matrix is a 4 by 4 matrix. So if you were to consider, like, usual spins will be 2 by 2. But 4 by 4 versus 2 by 2 is not the point. So the point is that you have multiple bands. So in this case, two bands, and they're called heavy and light holes. Now, and the simple, okay, so this is obvious boundary condition for the wave function. And, well, you can send, okay, so let me consider a simple problem. Let me send an incident wave, which is a heavy hole, so it means that it's in one of the bands, towards the boundary. So if there were no spin orbit coupling, I would just get a reflected wave, which, and with the angle of reflection, which is exactly equal to the angle of incidence. But in the case of spin orbit coupling, so the wave is reflected in all bands. So even if I send, you know, a particle in a certain band, so I choose a certain, you know, configuration of my wave function, and I choose a spinner, you know, has a non-zero component for one band, and all other components are zero. So it turns out that, well, it's reflected on all bands. So, and what is important is that the angle of reflection of the light hole is larger than the angle of incidence of the heavy hole. And what is even more important is that there is a critical angle, which I denote as theta C, after which, so the light holes are not reflected from the boundary at all, but they actually localize and near the surface. So if you basically can derive the wave function, you can, it exponentially decays away from the boundary.
And what so is localization radius?
So it actually depends on the angle. Mm-hmm. So I will show you in a second. So, but and actually, so a kind of useful analogy that I like, I'm not sure it's completely correct, but so suppose, okay, we know that there is a so-called total internal reflection in optics when you have two media with the different indices of refraction. So and suppose I send a light beam from the medium of high index of refraction. This would correspond to heavy hole. So it can reflect, which means in this language remains a heavy hole, or it can refract and propagate in the other medium, which will correspond to the situation in which I have a light hole. So if I have an angle of incidence which is very large, I will have a total internal reflection, which in some sense is similar to what I have here. So it's a, but okay.
Excuse me, is there,
yeah.
Metal is not the band incident. This edge state is related to the angle. This edge state corresponds to any topology of the band structure.
No, I'm not sure there is a lot of topology involved here. It's just, you know, you cannot satisfy energy and momentum conservation, basically, for this. So it's a really very simple exercise. You will have it in any spin orbit coupled system. So I know that there are, you know, some H states in insulators, you know, that you study. So it's different, I guess. So, and you can do different kinds of boring things, which I don't want to discuss. So, but. So in principle, you can derive this angle, and you can formulate, you can find the full basis for the problem. So by the way, this angle is determined just by the ratio of the masses of these two types of carriers. So if the ratio is equal to 1, so it means no spin orbit coupling. Well, and so this is some expression for the wave function. I don't want you to concentrate on that. But what is important is that this, you know, for this localized, in this localized state, so this momentum essentially is complex number, and so the wave function is localized in this direction. And what is even more important is that these localized states have a non-zero expectation value of this spin or spin 3 half. So if you calculate the average value of the spin component, corresponding spin component with respect to these localized states, you would get a non-zero result. Well, and of course, I mean, if this localized state propagates, say, to the right, so the spin will be, say, in this direction. If it propagates to the left, it will be in the opposite direction. So if you have equal number of carriers propagating in the both direction, so the total spin is zero. But if you have a preferential direction of motion in the system, for instance, you apply current, okay, or electric field, and you can, well, so you will get a non-zero result. So and so you can basically calculate observables directly. It's a simple analytical exercise. And so the result of this would be some oscillatory function of the spin as a function of the distance from the boundary. And I want to emphasize that this so this result is coming mostly from these localized states that I just described. Okay, so they are very important in getting this result. And well, these are nothing but just Friedel oscillations, actually. So if you think about it, like for instance, if you put a boundary in Fermi gas, you definitely will get oscillations in the density with a period of 2 pi. Nothing wrong with that. But if you calculate the integral over the density from 0 to infinity, you will get 0 because the charge is conserved. But if you have a spin orbit coupled system, the spin is not conserved, and you get some kind of Friedel oscillations of the spin density. Yeah, but if you calculate the total spin density by just integrating over the distance away from the boundary, you'll get a non-zero result. And this is something you can call spin accumulation, and you can calculate zero a linear response with respect to this thing. So this is basically the bottom line. So, and well, you can actually derive.
You do it in the presence of an electric field?
Well, so if there is, okay, so if you have completely clean system and the electric field applied, electrons will just accelerate. So this is a problem here. So, but if you, for instance, you can consider a situation in which you have some disorder, but you look at the length scales, which are much smaller than the mean free path, or you have a voltage, okay, which drops in the conducts, and so there is no electric field in the bulb. There is no, so there is a current, but there is no like electric field. There is no infinite acceleration. So in this case, yes, I mean, you will get this effect.
Electric field is applied in what direction?
Well, so. Parallel to the boundary. So if you have a boundary, you apply electric field parallel to
perpendicular to y. So
yeah. So
long x.
Yeah. So you have three directions, right? So one is basically the boundary, and along this boundary you apply electric field. So you have a normal
and
to the boundary.
Will be perpendicular.
Yes. Correct.
Your v on the previous transparency is a difference between the chemical potentials for right-left movers, or what is the previous?
Well, so basically, well, I would like to just concentrate, for instance, so this is the result, and there is some delta k here, which is basically, you know, the shift of the Fermi surface. So if you have, for instance, you have a voltage drop which occurs only in the conduct. So I don't want to talk about the situation when you actually have electric field in a clean system. Because again, I mean, it's kind of meaningless thing. You will have time-dependent density and accelerating electrons. But if you, in a real system, you may should just, you know, apply voltage, and you will have
along the boundary.
Yes.
So again, you have right and left moors with different chemical potentials. Is that what you?
Yeah, more or less.
You're right,
or yes, more or less. Yeah, that's what. We're back here.
So, I didn't understand that your answer. So you have electric field, and how magnetic field knows where or spin where to go.
Well, there is normal to the boundary, so there is a vector normal to the boundary, and there is electric field, so it kind of produces cross product.
Yeah, I understand.
So and again, so you can actually even calculate the periods of this. And just one thing, it's not really perhaps extremely exciting, but what you can get is that these are not really Friedel oscillations; these are Friedel beatings because you have several Fermi surfaces. Okay, two Fermi surfaces.
This is without electric field. Yeah?
Well, this is with electric field, but
okay, without there's
no field.
Well, there is no field. There is some differential. Okay, yeah. So there is some shift in the basically. you just assume that there is okay.
I think it's difficult once more to the previous new graph, and it will resolve. So as far as I understand, you just plug in a distribution function of electrons that has a step at kz equals zero. Okay,
right.
So you have larger Fermi surface for right movers and smaller Fermi surface for left movers.
Yes, is it more or less. More or less,
okay,
yeah.
This jump is EV over 2 divided by KF.
Yes.
Okay.
So that's what. Oh, sorry. That's what it is. Yes. So, but so, and you have oscillations, and these oscillations actually have three periods, corresponding to the fact that you have two Fermi surfaces, and there are three vectors which you can construct there. So psi is the difference. Okay, the ratio of the light pole and heavy pole masses. So okay.
And if you have two boundaries, say.
Okay, this is just with one boundary. Right. So with two boundaries, you will have the opposite spin accumulation.
Right. Opposite. Okay.
Yes. Okay, so this was about Lin systems. Now what you have in the solar systems, well, the solar systems, in fact, what you can do, you can, okay, so I kind of completed the first part about Lin systems, and so the bottom line was basically the effect is due to these localized H states, which is somewhat interesting. And this is consistent with the predictions of the spin current theory, but it's not completely clear how to relate it, you know, quantitatively. So again, so now I want to consider a situation in which you actually have disorder in the system, which is the real situation. You do have disorder in the system. In this case, the usual approach is to try to look at the system in some kind of hydrodynamic approximation. So what is hydrodynamic approximation? You assume that there is a length scale which is much larger than the mean free path, essentially. So you want, okay, I'll explain it in a second. So so you have actually several length scales in your problem in the presence of disorder. So of course you have Fermi wavelength, and this is the smallest length scale that you want. Just to, for semi-classics to work. So this is the mean free path, which is basically the distance between impurities. And actually there is an emergent, okay, new length scale, which I'll explain in a second, which is spin diffusion length. So what is spin diffusion length? Now, it's related to Dyakonov-Perel spin relaxation. So if you have disorder and you have spin orbit coupling, so what is spin orbit coupling? It's basically it's a Ziemann coupling to momentum-dependent magnetic field. So what you have is spin precession around certain momentum-dependent axis, right? So in the case of Rajbo model, this momentum-dependent magnetic field is just perpendicular to the direction of motion. Now, in the presence of disorder, there is some momentum relaxation. So it's a particle scatter over the impurities, and so this leads to the, basically, this randomizes the spin precession axis. So, and what you get at the end of the day is basically some random diffusion on the sphere. So without disorder, you would just have spin precession around constant axis. So with disorder, this axis changes all the time. And so you end up with having spin relaxation. So an experimental manifestation of that would be, for instance, if you inject spin density and you look at the time dependence of the spin density, it will just relax to zero. So it's not conserved. And the mechanism is this. Now,
is this different than, I mean, is there a qualitative difference from this? If you don't have spin orbit, actually, you have magnetic impurities, let's say. And the hydrodynamics is
no, I think it's going to be a bit different. So, so you just have exchange term, it's just like exchange term,
yeah,
with local magnetic impurity.
Okay, it doesn't matter. Okay.
Yeah, maybe it's similar, but here here there is no magnetic impurities.
Okay.
There are no magnetic impurities. There is only you know kind of coupling between the spin of the electron and its own motion.
Why the the first length mean free pass for relaxation of momentum doesn't coincide with spin?
Well, that's what I'm about to explain. So, well, basically, what you need, suppose that the spin orbit coupling is zero. Okay, so there is so the spin relaxation length is infinity because there is no spin relaxation.
Yeah.
So if you make it very small, basically what you have to calculate is how many times an electron have to scatter over the impurities to for the spin to rotate, like you know to flip basically. And it doesn't have to be you know 1L. So if it's 1L, it means that it's very strong, you know, spin orbit coupling. So but anyway, so what you can do, you can develop a diffusion equation formalism, and in this case you get, unlike in this charge step that you get here for spins, you basically have the term which is 1 over tau s. And this is this, okay, spin relaxation time, how long it takes for electron to lose the memory about its spin. And in principle, it can be much larger than the mean free path. And if this is the case, you can use this hydrodynamic approximation. So this is basically the condition of applicability of the diffusion equation. And well, the diffusion equation, if you actually figure out the parameters, so it turns out that the appropriate parameter is the spin orbit coupling energy scale divided by the Fermi energy, and this must be much smaller, not compared to 1, but to 1 over E Fermi tau, essentially. So yeah. It's very actually strong inequality. So, but it can be satisfied in two-dimensional Rajbrand-Dresselhaus model, but it's definitely not satisfied in Leitinger model. So sometimes you may use the diffusion approximation, sometimes you have to be careful about that. Well, so, and I don't know, I just will perhaps explain in some detail how to do that. So, to derive the usual diffusion equation, what you have to do, you have to just, calculate this bubble, which is the diffusion, and there is nothing in the vertices here. To derive spin diffusion equation, all you have to do, you have to put, Pauli matrices in the vertices. So sigma I, I actually can be 0, x, y, z. So 0 corresponds to charge, x, y, z correspond to the spin components, x, y, z spin components. So what you have to do, you have to basically calculate this thing. So this is the Green's function of an electron in real space. And it depends, it has some metric structure because you have spin orbit coupled Hamiltonian. And you put in, these Pauli matrices between the Green's function, and you just calculate the trace. So, and what you end up with is some kind of spin charge diffusion equation. And in this position representation, it originally is an integral equation, actually. So this object, well, strictly speaking, is just a kernel of this integral equation. And it has some non-trivial metric structure, it's 4x4 matrix, which corresponds to speed, to charge, and 3 spin degrees of freedom. Now, but in this hydrodynamic approximation, what you see is that you have a new length scale in the problem. You assume that there exists this length scale in the problem. And you say, well, my Green's function in the presence of disorder, with or without spin orbit interaction, they decay exponentially at the distance for their mean free path. So they're almost local. And this object is, this object pi, again, with or without spin orbit coupling, is just like a delta function. So and what you can do, you can expand basically this equation, this integral equation, in terms of this L. So you basically send L to zero, and you look for the expression of this kernel. And what you get is, this is 1 times delta function. We'll just cancel this rho on the left-hand side. So this is the usual diffusion equation. D over dt times d, Laplacian. D is the diffusion coefficient. But also you have a bunch of corrections, which is due to the spin structure. And so this will be the...
I just realized you're not wearing a mic. Can you... That's for part of the talk. Why don't you... There's a microphone right there.
Oh. Do I need a mic?
Well, because they're probably recording it, so...
It doesn't matter anymore.
Sorry. It was my job to. Yeah, I didn't know about it. Now we can say anything we want.
Yeah, go ahead.
So, is this the last term that gives you decay of the
conservation?
It's not a divergence of a current.
No, not necessarily. So this is just trivial. Okay, not trivial. This is just the diffusion equation, which you get anyways. But there are also corrections to it. And so the corrections actually give many different terms. And this is the most general form of this equation in real space. Well, basically what you do, you expand it. Okay, so you have your equation terms, omega and q, and then translate it into derivatives.
Right, but it's the second term that's the spin orbit.
So basically, the first term is just spin precession. So it's coupling between different components of the spin. And it turns out that this term is proportional to the first power of spin orbit interaction. So the second term is spin relaxation, which I described. In fact, it's proportional to the second power of the spin orbit interaction. And so the last term is spin charge coupling. So this is, for instance, if you have a current, like electric field, and you have a current, and there is a coupling between this current and a certain component of the spin. And this is the effect, basically, I was discussing. So you have an interesting
electric field.
Yeah, so if you apply, if you have current, you can charge current in the system, it induces some spin-dependent phenomenon. And so,
this is precession around what? There is some self-consistent field, or what?
Well, no, I mean, it's just a name for it. So basically, what it says is that, so you have, if you didn't have any spin orbit interaction, in fact, you have diffusion equation for a charge and for all components of the spin, but they're identical to each other in some sense. There is no coupling between different components of the spin. So for instance, if you somehow create, you know, a current of the X component of the spin or some kind of, okay, something non-trivial corresponding to the X component of the spin, there will be nothing, you know, in the Z component. So here it's not the case, in fact. So if you, so the different components of the spin are coupled to each other. And this is very important.
But do you need, in this case, so that the center of inversion is absent here? Because B alpha beta gamma is third order tensor. It doesn't exist if there is center of symmetry.
Well, I guess, I mean, okay, in two-dimensional systems, I mean, that's what I'm talking about. I mean, the spin of the coupling in the first place is coming from the absence of this symmetry. So, I mean, if you have the symmetry, you don't have any effect whatsoever. Not only this term, you have nothing. So,
can I ask also,
yeah, sure.
It's probably not the subject you talk, but still kind of interesting. I mean, are quantum effects ever important and sort of beyond quantum corrections for this ever important? This equation is a saddle point equation. You've integrated the fermions out, now you have some saddle point equation.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say I integrated. Okay, this is a quasi-classical expression in terms of, you know, one or P Fermi L. So there is no, like, weak localization correction or something like that. Mm-hmm. So the question, I guess, what you're asking, I mean, if, for instance, if you didn't have any spin orbit interaction, what would be the first quantum correction? What would be correction, weak localization correction to the diffusion coefficient? Well, you have something like that here. But even without this, it's quite complicated. So I'm not talking about it. Okay. So anybody can do that, no problem. So I think it has been done. I think actually most situations with spin orbit coupling, at least for charge part, so you actually have anti localization. But it's not something I did. So anyway, so you can study this equation. That's what we did, and we perhaps I should. I'm running low on time, so I should kind of speed up. So if you have a boundary and you go very far from the boundary, all your derivatives essentially can say that they are zero. And so the only thing you are left with is, if you have a kind of a current, is this term, which is non-zero, which is spin relaxation, and the current. And just by equating these two terms, you get a kind of uniform polarization in the bulk. Okay, so this is far from the boundaries. Now, if you want to find something near the boundaries, and that's what has been studied in experiment, you actually have to solve this diffusion equation. Well, you can rescale your spin density with respect to this bulk spin polarization, and you get this, you know, the equation in this form. You can replace your derivative with, you know, IQ, and you will get a 3x3 matrix which you need to diagonalize. So you will get this cubic equation, and it's possible. Actually, we looked at it for the most general case, and it's very easy to prove that the eigenvalues are this. So, the solution near the boundary is very simple. So it's almost trivial. So you have basically, just exponentially decaying term. It's just if you have just one boundary, and also exponentially decaying term, and some oscillation cosine basically here. And this corresponds to this basically this eigenvalues of the corresponding diffusion equation. Well, and so if you try to solve this diffusion equation, meaning if you want to find the coefficient of this solution, so there are some equations missing. So just knowing the diffusion equation is not enough. And there has been some intense discussion about how to do it. So the problem is that, well, you have three components of the spin. You have two amplitudes and one phase shift. So for each component, okay, you have to multiply it by three. So you have nine parameters that you need to determine. So if you work out the diffusion equation, it will give you six relations. So you need three more conditions to find the parameters. And so what you basically need is boundary conditions for this spin. And usually, I mean, it's not a problem to formulate a boundary condition. You just say, well, I have charge transport and charge is conserved. So if I have, for instance, hard wall boundary, it just doesn't propagate through the boundary. So in the current, okay, so basically your boundary condition will be that, you know, I times n is equal to zero. But here it's a little bit of a problem because spin is not conserved. Okay, you of course can define something that you call current, but you have to be careful about how you define it. So they're ambiguous. Okay, so it's not clear what you do. So it was not completely obvious how to deal with these boundary conditions, and it turned out that you actually have to derive them. That's what I convinced myself. And so we developed a method again, so I'm not going to go into great detail. So, but I would like to mention, so this was done by Burkov and Sarma and me. So you can develop a method of how to regularly derive this boundary condition for this non-trivial diffusion problem. So it turns out that in optics, people looked at similar problems, and one can put just a very so-called Milne problem in optics, which you can map onto this spin diffusion problem. And so, again, so the main idea
is the new ingredient is there's non-conservation. Right?
Yes. Okay. So in optics, they actually look for some coefficients, you know, in next to leading order in these boundary conditions or something like that. So, but they have the method correct. So they have all the ingredients to build, you know, this method. And so the method basically takes advantage of the existence of some kind of hierarchy of length scales in the problem. So in your problem, you have, Fermi wavelength, you have a mean free path, and you have spin diffusion length. And these are completely different length scales. So diffusion equation doesn't know about what's going on at the length scales of order L. So it only knows about what's going on, you know, at larger length scales. If you were to just put, your spin density, for instance, zero at the boundary, you would get trivial boundary conditions that were always equal to zero, but it's not going to be correct. What you actually have to do, you have to take a point which is smaller than L, but larger than lambda Fermi. So from the point of view of the diffusion equation, this is zero. But it's not zero if you kind of resolve this operator, if you go back to the integral equation, resolve this operator at the length scales, which know about the Fermi wavelength and the mean free path. And the Green's function definitely know about these things. So what you actually have to do, you have to go back to the integral equation near the boundary.
So the diffusion equation is defined on the scale larger than L, right?
Yes, right.
Okay, so that's okay. So that can be discontinued. It effectively looks like it's discontinuous. It goes to a finite value at the boundary, right?
Finite value of what?
I don't know. Meaning it doesn't have to be... It doesn't have to vanish at the boundary.
No, it doesn't. Oh, so the density, so the diffusion equation described in terms of densities, and the densities don't have to vanish at the boundary, but they can vanish at the boundary if the boundary is transparent. So anyway, so this is how you can do it, and, well, again, so let me skip the technical details. And so so the bottom line here is that, so if you have, for instance, a boundary with the reflectivity R, so this would be your boundary conditions without spin-orbit interaction. So you just expand, you just do kind of gradient expansion near the boundary. So if the boundary is completely, if you just, for instance, a hard wall, the reflection coefficient is equal to 1. So you have 1 plus 1 over 2. And so these terms cancel each other out. And you have boundary condition, which is that the derivative of the current is equal to 0. The derivative of the density is equal to 0, that this current is equal to 0. Mm-hmm. Now, if R is not 0, so if the boundary is kind of transparent, so R is less than 1. And so the leading order boundary condition is just the Dirichlet boundary condition that is, the density is equal to 0. So and these are the typical boundary conditions that you get in the charge diffusion problem. Now, the spin diffusion problem turns out that in the case of a boundary which is not transparent, it's not enough just to take this derivative equals to 0, because there are other terms of the same order which are coming from the spin-orbit interaction. And so you actually have to figure them out. And the corresponding boundary condition is rather complicated. So in fact, you have a boundary condition which couples different components of the spin. So you have kind of matrix, so this is a matrix, well, boundary matrix B, which one can derive. And, for instance, the boundary conditions will be, this is normal to the boundary, this is mean free path, this is derivative. So if you have, for instance, Z component of the spin, it may couple to the X component of the spin or something like that. And well, on principle, you can call it spin current, if you want. So this.
And if there is no, so coefficient C is due to the current.
Yes.
Right? So if there is no current, then you have relation.
Yeah, if there is no current, this will be just this.
Could you explain what has happened? Here you have M scalarly multiplied by gradient, and that is scalar. But on the right side, you have gradient itself, which is vector.
No, but it's also a vector. It's bold, but it's not maybe resolved at least.
But A is here and here, so A is okay.
So A is the index which kind of labels spin direction.
No questions about
so this is
questions the principal charge. Gradient.
So this one?
Yeah.
So this is also a vector.
So this is I see.
So it's just, it's bold, but it's a bold form.
Yeah.
it's just a vector here. Okay, so you can solve this diffusion equation for the two types of boundary conditions. And so there was, so if you have transparent boundaries, the condition is just this, and you get something, which has perhaps absolutely nothing to do with what I talked about in the Glim case, because it's a completely different length scale. So the Fermi wavelength is just lost here. But there is a new length scale, which is the spin diffusion length, which is much, much larger than the Fermi wavelength. So, and if you have international boundary, for instance, the Rushmore actually is quite tricky. So, if you have a quadratic spectrum and a Hardwell boundary, you actually don't have any spin accumulation, it seems, at least in the lowest order. But if you, okay, so if you play around with the spectrum and you, for instance, you consider a Hardwell boundary, instead of Hardwell boundary, you can consider a WQB boundary in principle, you have different types of boundary conditions. So, the bottom line here is that, in fact, the observable effect in disordered systems actually depends on the structure of the boundary. So even without spin currents, you may have spin accumulation. So this was at least what my understanding is. So basically, people are, so what experimentalists are looking at is basically something which happens near the boundary. So you, they have some spin density near the boundaries. And this particular spin density will depend strongly on the boundary conditions which are related to the structure of the boundary itself. Okay, so let me, I don't know, how much time do you want me to finish or?
Okay, well, so how much do you have?
Well, I don't know, so maybe 15 minutes?
Yeah, that's fine.
Sorry.
I think that's fine.
So, yeah, I can just stop it.
No,
it just,
no, you know, no, so I think it's fine. We started 5 minutes later.
Okay, so actually I was going to talk about this because I thought Gerald Moore will be here because he's one of the authors on this paper. So this was just... so the paper was... actually it's an experimental paper in which people basically look at the following experiment. It has now nothing to do with the electric field or anything, but they inject spin density and just look what happens to it. So, and this is time dependence, basically, of the spin density at different different distances from the point where they injected. So and you see that there are oscillations of the spin density.
So they inject it into what? What are they injecting?
So basically, they create, actually what they do, they kind of create kind of a wave spin. Okay.
But what kind of material is it they're injecting into?
Well, I think it's indium arsenide.
Yeah.
And they, I think that with two light beams, they create a very structure of spin accumulation and depletion in the beginning. And then they turn off the light.
Okay. So it's not a magnetic material?
I don't think it's magnetic material. It's orientation by light.
Okay, induces them.
It is a magnetic moment.
Okay. But there's no, it's not a magnetic material, it's just it's, there is spin orbit.
Right. So basically, because of spin orbit interaction for holes, I think you can, when you excite So, in the semiconductor, okay, if you shine light which creates interband transitions from valence band to conduction band, and you shine polarized light, because for light holes, spin and moment are collinear, and with circular light you create certain spin direction, right? You also create some p, but what's important is that basically because of spirality of photon you can create certain distribution. Mm-hmm. So if you have two light beams, I think you can make a standing wave. Yeah. And I think the idea was that you could create a standing wave and you turn off the light and see how fast the diffuses away.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So and basically, one of the features here, one of the interesting features is this time, real-time oscillation, actually, in this event. So basically, spin density is a function of time.
And what is time, dude? What is unit of time?
That's a good question. I don't know. But it's, okay, it's a order of this tau s.
Pretty short.
Yeah.
It's drawers, it's a steric here. Affiliation is.
So, anyways, so and actually, in this paper, okay, it is an experimental paper that there is also a reasonable, very reasonable, and I think particularly good theory. So, basically, we suggest that these oscillations are due to, and also the observed enhancement of charge diffusion coefficient, and this was due to the Coulomb interaction. So, we kind of looked at this experiment from a different angle. So what you want to do basically to describe relaxation of say charge density in terms of diffusion equation, you want to find the Green's function of the diffusion equation. So suppose you inject something into a point and then you just look at the behavior of the density as a function of time and distance. So by definition, so the Green's function of the diffusion equation will determine what this behavior is. So what you have to do, you have to invert your basically diffusion matrix and do Fourier transform. So you invert it, okay, as a function of omega and q, and do Fourier transform. Now, and while you get this behavior, which have absolutely no oscillations, of course, neither in real space nor in time. But if you are dealing with spin charge coupled diffusion, what you have to do actually, you have to not invert, you don't have to invert like I omega plus dq squared. You have to invert a matrix. And you know, have determinants and
but you also had all these other terms in there, like this
processional
term.
Yes. So and so if you just so what we did basically we derived the diffusion equation which has all the terms for Dirichlet, Gauss, cubic and linear quadratic. So it's the most general diffusion equation, which actually looks surprisingly simple. We inverted this matrix, so it's rather straightforward. So if you just concentrate on the spin sector of the diffusion equation, so I remind you, the diffusion equation has kind of, so it has charge component and spin component. So in principle, they're coupled. But under certain circumstances, which is basically the applicability of the diffusion equation, you can just concentrate on the spin part, which is 3x3 matrix. So if you do this, for instance, in the Rajman model, you can derive, well, the corresponding, you know, Green's function. And it is a matrix which has, you know, three indices, three pairs of indexes. For instance, this is just an example of what you see. So this is actually a real space and time dependence of the ZZ component in the Rajman model. So the physics of this, you inject the Z component in the pure Rajman model, and look what happens with this Z component as a function of time and distance. Mm-hmm. And at large times, you can just derive it. Okay, gamma is a parameter which labels, you know, this Rajman interaction term, doesn't matter, it's dimensionless. So what you kind of have a Bessel function here. It oscillates in real time, or in real space. And you have spin relaxation. So you have this exponential behavior, which you don't have in the usual charge diffusion, because, you know, charge is conserved, there is no charge relaxation. So this is just an example of what you see. So and these are, this is behavior of the spin density as a function of time. There is no oscillation here, but there are oscillations in real space. Yes?
So the period of oscillations is what is spin orbit? What is the period of oscillations?
So the period is just, it's. I should have told it, yeah, it's in the units of this spin diffusion length. So everything is rescaled. So the initial parameters, there is just natural parameter of time, which is tau s, the spin relaxation time, and natural parameter of length, which is spin diffusion length. So it's measured in terms of the spin diffusion length, which is diffusion coefficient time. So you can figure this out.
So but I don't understand where oscillations came from. So you start with some direction of spin.
No, the oscillations are coming from, okay, let me just show you the other result, and you will perhaps understand where they're coming from. So what you...
Maybe it's better to go
back.
I mean,
maybe it's better to go back.
So the diffusion equation.
So, you're right. Maybe I can just mention it here. So so in principle, what you have to do, you have... So you have this kind of, so this is your Green's function, but in momentum space. And this is now a matrix. Okay? So what you have to do first, you have to find the solution of this equation. Mm-hmm. So now, without, if there were no spin orbit coupling, so this equation will be just this. Mm-hmm. Stable. It doesn't have any complex part, if you want.
Yep.
But now, if you include spin orbit coupling, now it's a matrix, it may have complex solutions.
Okay, can you go back to your, you had this equation already.
With the equation, it's not going to help very much, because you actually have to do a calculation theorem. So, yeah.
I guess I'm just wondering which.
Okay. Well, for example, here there is a Q, which is.
This one, yeah. So what? Yeah. Which terms are the things that give you oscillations?
Well, you have to study all the terms. It's not that you have some terms which you can drop.
I guess it's the first term on the right hand side. Because
so you have all the terms. So here you plug in. Okay, so this is I omega, this is Q squared, this is Q gamma. Well, this is something else. So this is, right. So this is basically, this is some matrix. You have to just work it out. And you have to find the determinant of the matrix, and we'll have complex components. So, and these will be responsible for the oscillation. But, okay, in the case when you just confine yourself to the situation when you have only 3x3, you know, spin diffusion, you don't have any real-time oscillations. But
what is gamma r in this language? Is there a gamma r?
Gamma r, okay, it's better. Okay, so gamma r is basically, okay, for simplicity, let me... So you have a Hamiltonian, right? Okay, for instance, this is a radical Hamiltonian. So this is some parameter, alpha. Mm-hmm. So gamma r is a dimensionless parameter, which is this.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, some, maybe there is a 2 or something, but this is the order of magnitude. So basically...
Just tells you how strong the...
And you consider it bigger than 1?
No. If I consider it bigger than one, actually it's very strong spin orbital. Mm-hmm. Well.
I think the question came because it has square root of gamma squared minus 1.
Yeah.
Gamma
force minus 1.
Yeah.
So that is imaginary, something imaginary, yeah? Because
gamma is less than 1. So in principle, in my equation, so we didn't actually make any approximations.
Then there is no oscillation in your J0.
No. I mean, this has nothing to do with gamma to the fourth. So you can just do exact calculation. That was the only point.
No, but he's saying that the parameter is...
I should have written here.
Yes. So if gamma is less than 1, then gamma to force minus 1 is less than negative. Square root is imaginary, and that is J0 on imaginary arc.
There should be the other way around, perhaps. I'm sorry about that. Yeah. So you just have these oscillations.
You would think the oscillations would be stronger if you had strong couple.
So there should be a modulus here, perhaps.
One magnet.
I'm sorry about that.
Actually, same. It looks very strange. I have no idea where this answer came from, and I don't understand the physics of the oscillations. Sorry, but I would think that if spin orbit interaction is weak, then the pitch must become large,
mm-hmm.
right? And if it's strong, then the pitch must be short. Now, if I believe that it's just a typo, then gamma, small gamma is in the denominator. So it looks like this, the pitch scales as gamma rather than 1 over gamma. So that is strange. See what I mean? I would think that periodicity should increase if I turn off spin orbit interaction. Because it's some kind of precession.
Well, actually, right? No. But in some sense, you have spin orbit interaction also in the length scales and in time scales. So if you rescale everything in terms of the spin diffusion length and spin realization time, actually different terms will essentially become of the same order. So that's the point. That's the reason you write this diffusion equation in the first place.
This actually, letter R is distance.
R is distance in the units of the spin diffusion.
And also something wrong is in your exponential, because if gamma is very small, okay. Then the neglect gamma r square, gamma r force, we left with minus 1, and another minus is plus. So it grows with time.
No, okay, so it can grow with time, so perhaps should have been more careful writing this.
Probably gamma is large when alpha is
small. Probably gamma is large.
Gamma is 1 over gamma.
If gamma is 1 over alpha, then this
thing. If gamma is large, then...
What is better than that limit?
It's going up in time.
Yeah.
And both at large and small.
Yes. It must be a bound on the combo.
That's the same thing. Maybe we should take this formula away.
Yeah.
It's clearly wrong.
So, but in any case, so if you actually, so the bottom line is that you actually have to work out this determinant, yeah. And you will, if you rescale everything in terms of the spin diffusion length, all the terms become of the same order, and you will get complex results. And if you now include the spin charge coupling, you can, and you consider basically go to this experiment, mm-hmm. okay, so this is the experimental picture in which you have the spin, so-called spin grating amplitude as a function of time. What you really want is to find these diffusion propagators as a function of time and momentum, because this is the momentum with which they inject the spin density. And so you have some amplitudes which depend on momentum, and you have some spin relaxation, or whatever relaxation which depends on momentum. And if all I omegas are real, so you have no oscillations in this dependence. But you can, again, so you can just, using the 4x4 matrix for the spin charge coupled diffusion equation, you can find the dependence of the, you have four roots mm-hmm. for this omega, okay? So, and if you do just exactly the calculation, so you get a term, which is square root of 1 minus 32, okay, whatever, pi squared, so this is factor of order 1, you would say. So G is actually a conductance. And alpha as well, in this case, actually it's not gamma R, so gamma R is something else, you should remind yourself. So this is alpha, alpha is basically this dimensionless spin orbit coupling, and k is the wave vector which is measured in inverse spin diffusion length. So the applicability of the diffusion approximation is that this g a alpha must be much smaller than 1.
What is g?
G is the conductance dimensionless, or e Fermi tau essentially. So this must be much smaller than 1 if you want the diffusion approximation to work. But it's multiplied by this huge factor, so it appears that it might be that, you know, this experiment actually may become complex, in which case you will have oscillations actually. Mm-hmm. So, and if you...
Was the L in the figure the different lengths?
So it's basically, my understanding is that just they look at the spin density at different distances. Yeah, different temperatures.
I just wonder if we can understand the trend with temperature.
No, I don't think that you can kind of map this, you know, like that. So, but let me just, you know...
Well, the oscillations are...
So this is the solution, basically theoretical solution. So if you have weak spin charge coupling, that is spin charge coupling, so that this square root, in some sense, the corresponding square root is real. So you just have relaxation of this thing to zero. But if you have relatively strong spin charge coupling, so it's actually not very strong because of the numerical factor, you will have oscillations. So another thing you will have actually, if you look, for instance, in the behavior of the charge dynamics, you will get some kind of effective enhancement of the diffusion coefficient, which for charge, so which seems to be to have been observed in experiment. So I should mention that all these results rely on some kind of extrapolation of the domain of applicability of this diffusion equation.
So you're saying that I'm interested. So if one measure, this df is what is for charge. So if one measure of conductivity extracts from the formula.
No, I think, well, basically, if you what I'm saying is that here, if you just invert, you know, d00 component of the diffuse zone, which corresponds to charge, so it's a function of q, it will decay like that, and so there will be a kind of correction to it.
Yeah, but you're talking about a zero quantity, so I wanted to ask, so if I measure conductivity.
I don't think you can relate it to conductivity, but you can perhaps relate it to relaxation.
Why not? Diffusion equation usually is perfectly through the formula, right?
Well, I haven't thought about it, but maybe, yes, maybe you will have a correction to the conductivity.
So df is what is diffusion of charge?
Well, so what I'm saying here is that you have diffusion matrix. You know, it has many components. You know, it has zero component and, you know, spin components. You can invert it, you can find what it is. So you can look at the time dependence of the, say, zero component, which you can, you know, which is the charge part.
Right. So I take the same diffusion equation. I add a term which corresponds to external electric field, which is coupling to charge, right? And for this equation, usually I would just do the.
Well, maybe I just didn't do that. So yeah, maybe that's.
But it's not, so you're saying that basically spin orbit interaction will increase mobility.
Well, so in some sense, this is just. Well, this is a little bit beyond the, I was about to say, yes, so within this approximation, yes, this is the result. But it turns out that the parameter of applicability of the diffusion equation is exactly this G alpha. And in fact, if you look at the, so this G alpha is actually must be very small. So now if you look at the experimental paper, actually, and if you figure out their parameters, in fact, they're actually working in the regime where this G alpha is not small. So it's not clear whether the diffusion approximation works very well. So in principle, well, to describe the situation when G alpha is large, you have to go beyond the diffusion approximation. You have to do something else. You have to do the Boltzmann equation.
Yeah. What is the physical picture? Why diffusion is enhanced?
Well, I don't really have a very good physical picture for that, actually.
Is that a bare tau there, or does tau also contain?
No, this tau is just a bare tau. Just a bare tau. So this is basically.
So is it enhanced?
So, but as I said, so in principle, one should be careful about applying this to real experiment because, first of all, in real experiment, again, so the diffusion approximation doesn't seem to work very well. So we can try to extend the domain of applicability of this and just say, well, that's more or less what's going on. But it's not clear whether this theory is quantitatively applicable. And there is basically no theory in the approximation when G alpha is of order 1. There is no existing theory, at least to the best of my knowledge. So, but you can, well, at least I think for this part, where you have these huge factors here enhancing the, you know, these corrections, mm-hmm. I think it's reasonable to assume that just due to the numerical value of this, if this is correct, so you may get actually spin oscillation. It may be the physics of what's going on. Okay, it's not physics, mathematics, really, of what's going on. But again, so it's an open question in the sense that, well, so there is no exact theory. So the previous results were okay. So in the sense that the diffusion approximation was consistent with the regime that I was looking at. So here I'm trying to
extend. Experimental pictures are dependent on time or what?
Yeah, it's time. It's time. So that's the point. So it's not clear how to.
So there are two modes, which are G alpha independent. I mean the frequencies. You just have k. Oh, but spin orbit still comes in because this k is rescaled, right?
Yes, yes. So k is always rescaled in terms of. So I'm just saying so that if you look at the corrections to two of the modes, in principle, you can get a complex answer. That's the only statement that I make here.
Could you compare your oscillation with these oscillations?
Well, I mean, I kind of compare it, but I'm not sure. Okay, in principle, so in their system, they have all kinds of spin orbit interactions. I don't really know what this system is. So in principle, well, I can do it in the Rajmo model, but it doesn't have to be a Rajmo model. It's just because we like the Rajmo model for some reason, we calculate everything for the Rajmo model. But in principle, there are many other terms in the Hamiltonian that can prepare. So, okay, we compare it in terms of the time scales, and it seems reasonable, but wouldn't, you know, try to put it on top of the experimental data and say that, well, we explain everything, no. So anyway, so this was just one remark about this experiment, which I was included. So, and yeah, I think I was...
Can you at least, do you want to at least tell us what?
Yeah, sure. So it's 5 minutes. It's going to be very quick. So call them finally. So
just so we can...
yeah, so lip service.
Put a chair, yeah, exactly.
There's no microphone to wear the mic now.
Huh? No, come on, the mic. No, the whole talk is about it.
They will get the wrong impression about what I do, which I don't want. Anyways, so in cold atoms, actually, you can prepare a spin orbit tuple of Hamiltonian systems. And the way to do this is the following. So suppose you have, you know, the Hamiltonian actually has a form. So you have a kinetic term, you have a trap, and also you have a kind of hyperfine structure for the particles in the trap. And this structure is just this. You have three levels coupled to an excited level zero. And so these are lasers which, okay, so this picture basically illustrates that there are lasers which couple, you know, level one to this excited level, et cetera, et cetera. So for me as a condensed matter theorist, it's something mysterious actually. But whenever I talk to atomic physicists, they say, well, it's trivial that we can do it like in 5 minutes or something. So it seems to be very reasonable actually. And the person who suggested this structure, his name is Chen-Wei Zhang, and he's an atomic physicist, and he kind of understood what it means. So that's my contribution here. Was
are these levels, are these a hyperfine state?
Yes. Yeah, so basically the Hamiltonian, so if you apply these lasers, which they do all the time,
right,
so you get a Hamiltonian which has this form. So this is basically just a term which couples, you know, 0 to 1, you know, 0 to 2, etc. And what I want is the laser field to be position dependent, which they can also do by just creating, you know, waves. Just periodic dependence you can always get. So now, what you want to
is
do...
Is periodic important? I mean, it doesn't have to be...
Yeah, well, okay. So for me, it's going to be important. So what I really want, I want to diagonalize this Hamiltonian, which means applying, again, a matrix, which diagonalizes it. So, well, there are ways to parameterize these frequencies, and it's not terribly important why it's this way, it's just the way the atomic physicists do it. So these omega-1, omega-2, omega-3 is these laser beams, and they parameterize these things in the Hamiltonian. Well, and if you solve, if you kind of find the spectrum in terms of this Hamiltonian, that means if you diagonalize this Hamiltonian, so what you will get is a pair of degenerate states, which they call dark states, which are well separated from the other two states. And my understanding is that you can actually have this...
diagonalize a fixed R or what?
Yes, so basically...
So no kinetic energy.
So basically what you have a certain... matrix, which actually depends on R.
With this energy, for different R, you will have different vectors.
No, but you always will have kind of... You always will have two degenerate states. That's just the property of this system, which you can figure out if you just look at the matrix. So you will always have a degenerate case, and this will be my essentially spin one, spin up, or spin down in my language. Now, if I find the matrix which diagonalizes my Hamiltonian, which depends on R, as you said, well, I can sandwich my Hamiltonian with this U dagger and U, and this will diagonalize the atomic, okay, the atom laser coupling part, but also there is just kinetic energy part. And so you will get the derivative of this U. Well, and if you if you now just concentrate on the on this,
so this is adiabatic approximation.
Hmm? Adiabatic approximation in the sense that so these only these two degenerate levels are important. And my understanding is that it's a very reasonable approximation. In fact, so it means that so you have four states to begin with, right? So if you diagonalize this Hamiltonian, you will have two states which are well separated from the other states. And you basically confine your Hilbert space just to this subspace of two degenerate states. And if you project your Hamiltonian, you can choose parameters in a certain way, which are reasonable from the experimental point of view. And there are two ways to look at this system in the end. So one description would be that you have some kind of non-abelian gauge potential, which basically means that you have just a matrix here. That's one way to think about it. It has been done in the context of atomic physics. There were papers on that. But there's another way to look at it. So what you have is basically, if you just expand this matrix, what you will get is just the usual kinetic energy plus the trap, plus some Zeeman field perhaps, and spin orbit interaction. It's not really a real spin. It's not real spin. It's these degenerate states which occur after the diagonalization of the Hamiltonian.
And the vector potential arises because of the overlap, because now from the kinetic energy term, right?
Yeah, so basically, again, so this kind of correction, if you want, it's not really correction.
As
so
a
this,
linear piece in
the moment. Yeah, so it's just the linear, actually. It's going to be linear. So the other will be canceled.
I see.
So anyway, so in this is just like spin orbit interaction. But sigma is not, it's not really, it doesn't have any real space significance in terms of Z and Y. It's just parameterization of these two levels. What you can have basically, you have more coupling of this degree of freedom to the motion of the particle in the trap.
Spaces you. So these are some kind of standing waves, and you.
Yes. It's standing wave, which they actually can do. So what you really want is you want standing wave. You don't want too complicated the dependence you see in this spin orbit coupling term. If it's too complicated, well, you will get something, but for me, it's not interesting because it doesn't work on the problems I know. Maybe it is interesting, but I just don't know what.
Yeah, where is the any waves coming here?
So, let me show you. So you have your original Hamiltonian, right? So it depends on omega 1, omega 2, omega 3. So they depend somehow on R. For example, the standing waves. Now, obviously, the matrix which diagonalizes the Hamiltonian depends on the form of the original Hamiltonian. Right. So this U.
On this R dependence.
Yeah. So there is some R dependence. And so what you want is this thing to be rather simple but still non-trivial. And the simplest thing that you can have is the standing wave. So basically cosines, whatever. You just think about it, and you will come up. And in fact, you can prepare. Okay. If this is reasonable, you can prepare different kinds of Hamiltonians which don't necessarily map on the Rajbo or whatever other term. But you can also get Rajbo, for example, or Dreyfushaus, I guess. So, but it doesn't have to be this. So we basically looked at it in a way, we said, well, so you have this spin orbit Hamiltonian, what can you do with it? So in condensed system, you will say let's study some linear response, spin diffusion, so there is no disorder, no diffusion, so there is no electric field, no transfer. But what you have is basically a problem which is, I think, rather interesting, maybe from a mathematical point of view. So what you actually have is the particles in the trap. Particles scatter off of the boundaries of the trap. So it's just like in the Diaghilev-Perel picture, when particles scatter off the disorder potential, so it randomizes momentum and you have kind of random spin precession. So here in this Hamiltonian, if we agree on the Hamiltonian, basically what you have trapped fermions, or even if you really like, you can consider bosons, I think. And so these particles are going to scatter off the boundaries, and every scattering will basically randomize in some sense the momentum of the particle. So there will be spin relaxation due to this. And so a problem that we studied for a particular choice of the spin orbit coupling is the following. So suppose you, actually it was a very simple choice of the spin orbit coupling. The simplest from the experimental point of view is some kind of Eason type spin orbit interactions, kind of trivial, I think. But what you can, actually, the kind of problems the kinds of problems that you can study is the following. Suppose we polarize all the spins in the one direction. That is, we just create all particles in one of these states. So we just put them in one state and let them go. And just look at the spin polarization, or this pseudo-spin polarization as a function of time. Well, obviously, well, you can just, you know, it's straightforward. You can write polarization, you know, as a function of time, just, you know, time evolution operators. And there is no problem to define it as a function of time. And what is interesting is that you actually can solve the problem exactly for the following reason. So if you have, you know, this harmonic potential, you can just write it in terms of A and A dagger, you know, just creation and annihilation operators. And P in the spin orbit coupling Hamiltonian will be just A minus A dagger or something, right? So actually what you have is A dagger A plus, you know, some coupling of these A's to a sigma, to the spin. So it's actually it's an exactly solvable model. Okay, there are some exactly solved models, but it's a very simple model. What I'm saying is that basically you have you know, harmonic oscillator coupled to a two-level system. And in the model that we started, which is, again, was very simple. So what we observed was depending on the strength of this spin orbit coupling, so to speak, you may have different types of behavior. So one. So suppose this is the t equals zero time, so all spins are polarized in one direction, so that is all particles in one state, and you let them go. So if the spin orbit coupling is weak, there is oscillation of this polarization, but it never kind of vanishes, it just oscillates with a period which is basically equal to the to the trapping frequency, if you have a harmonic trap. If the spin orbit coupling is strong, so it's very fast, strong actually meaning that the corresponding term in the Hamiltonian times the number of particles, nf, which is like a Fermi level. It is fair for fermions. So this guy must be large. So in the limit when the number of particles goes to infinity, you will have just delta function fixed, I guess. So this was derived in terms with no thermalization or anything like that. It was just quantum dynamics of the many body system. Strongly in equilibrium, quantum dynamics. So it always, it never equilibrates to any kind of finite temperature state. It just oscillates with the period of.
This is not real spin, but pseudo spin. What does it mean in physical world?
So how to observe it, basically, that's the question. So this is mostly the achievement of the atomic physicists in this paper. So it's apparently they can probe the number of spins in certain hyperfine state as a function of time. There is no problem with that. So in this case, just orientation, the direction of the spin will be basically the population of certain hyperfine state in the system. So which is seems to be experimentally feasible thing to measure. Although I can't say anything smarter than that. So,
is this an invasive probe, or they need to destroy the system each time they do it?
Well, as I said,
very likely destructive. Yeah. Usually these things are, right.
So, well, but this is just if you forget about how to measure it, so that's what happens. And well, another thing. Let me just say this. So we also studied an elliptic trap. An elliptic trap, when you basically have two-dimensional trap and you have two frequencies, two trapping frequencies in directions x and y. And, well, it appears that, so you may have different types. Okay, I don't want to spend any more time on that, but you have two theories of the oscillations. And maybe there is an interesting question that can be studied, like chaotic traps or something like that. So it seems to be an interesting thing to think about. But what we did was basically just pointing out that so if you have this position-dependent laser fields, it's basically equivalent to spin-orbit interaction. And so this is a new type of problem that you can study, which is more or less like mesoscopic. I mean, you can perhaps map it onto some quantum dot with spin-orbit coupling. I don't know. So, and well, that's pretty much. And I will just let you read the summary. Thanks very much for your attention.
Another question? If not, it's
okay.